Chapter 14. One Golden Day. Dawn was a beautiful haze of blue and gold. Bond went outside and ate his bean curd and rice and drank his tea sitting on the spotless doorstep of the little cut stone and timbered house, while indoors the family chattered like happy sparrows as the women went about their housework. Bond had been allotted the room of honour, the small sitting room with its tatami mats, scraps of furniture, house shrine, and a cricket in a small cage to keep you company, as Kissy had explained. Here, his futon had been spread on the ground, and he had for the first time, and with fair success, tried sleeping with his head on the traditional wooden pillow. The evening before, the father, an emaciated greybeard with knotted joints and bright squirrel eyes, had laughed with and at him as Kissy translated Bond's account of some of his adventures with Tiger, and there was from the first a complete absence of tension or self-consciousness. The priest had said that Bond should be treated as a member of the family, and although his appearance and some of his manners were strange, Kissy had apparently announced a qualified approval of him, and the parents followed her lead. At 9 o'clock, under the three-quarter moon, the father had beckoned to Bond and had hobbled out with him to the back of the house. He showed him the little shack with the hole in the ground and the neatly quartered pages of the Asahi Shimbun on a nail, and the last of Bond's private fears about life on the island was removed. His flickering candle showed the place to be as spotless as the house, and at least adequately salubrious. After the soft movements in the other two rooms had ceased, Bond had slept happily, and like the dead. Kissy came out of the house. She was wearing a kind of white cotton nightdress, and a white cotton kerchief bound up the thick black waves of her hair. She wore her equipment, the weights and the heavy flat angular pick, over the white dress, and only her arms and feet were bare. Bond may have shown his disappointment. She laughed, teasing him. "This is ceremonial dress for diving in the presence of important strangers. The Kanushi-san instructed me to wear it in your company, as a mark of respect, of course."
"Kissy, I believe that is a fib. The truth of the matter is that you consider that your nakedness might arouse dishonorable thoughts in my impious Western mind. That is a most unworthy suspicion. However, I accept the delicacy of your respect of my susceptibilities. And now let's cut the cackle and get going. We'll beat the Awabi record today. What should we aim at?"
50 would be good. 100 would be wonderful. But above all, you must row well and not let me drown. And you must be kind to David."
"Who's David?" asked Bond, suddenly jealous at the thought that he would not be having this girl to himself.
"Wait and see."
She went back indoors and brought out the balsa wood tub and a great coil of fine quarter-inch rope. She handed the rope to Bond and hoisted the tub on her hip, leading the way along a small path away from the village. The path descended slowly to a small cove in which one rowing boat, covered with dried reeds to protect it from the sun, was drawn high up on the flat black pebbles. Bond stripped off the reeds and laid them aside and hauled the simple, locally made craft down to the sea. It was constructed of some heavy wood and lay low but stable in the deeply shelving, totally transparent water. He loaded in the rope and the wooden tub. Kissy had gone to the other side of the little bay and had undone a string from one of the rocks. She began winding it in slowly and at the same time uttering a low, cooing whistle. To Bond's astonishment, there was a flurry in the water of the bay and a big black cormorant shot like a bullet through the shallows and waddled up the beach to Kissy's feet, craning its neck up and down and hissing, apparently in anger. But Kissy bent down and stroked the creature on its plumed head and down the outstretched neck, at the same time talking to it gaily. She came towards the boat, winding up the long line, and the cormorant followed clumsily. It paid no attention to Bond, but jumped untidily over the side of the boat and scrambled onto the small thwart in the bows, where it squatted majestically and proceeded to preen itself, running its long bill down and through its breast feathers and occasionally opening its wings to the full extent of their 5-foot span and flapping them with gentle grace. Then, with a final shimmy through all its length, it settled down and gazed out to sea with its neck coiled backwards as if to strike, and its turquoise eyes questing the horizon imperiously. Kissy climbed into the boat and settled herself with her knees hunched decorously between Bond's outstretched legs.
And Bond slid the heavy, narrow-bladed oars into their wooden rowlocks and began rowing at a powerful, even pace, more or less, under Kissy's direction, due north. He had noticed that Kissy's line to the cormorant ended with a thin, brass ring, perhaps 2 inches in diameter, round the base of the bird's neck. This would be one of the famous fishing cormorants of Japan. Bond asked her about it. Kissy said, "I found him as a baby 3 years ago. He had oil on his wings, and I cleaned him and cared for him and had him ringed. The ring has had to be made larger as he grew up. Now, you see, he can swallow small fish, but the big ones he brings to the surface in his beak. He hands them over quite willingly, and occasionally he gets a piece of a big one as a reward. He swims a lot by my side and keeps me company. It can be very lonely down there, particularly when the sea is dark. You will have to hold the end of the line and look after him when he comes to the surface. Today he will be hungry. He has not been out for 3 days because my father could not row the boat. I have been going out with friends, so it is lucky for him that you came to the island." "So, this is David."
"Yes. I named him after the only man I liked in Hollywood. An Englishman, as it happens. He was called David Niven. He is a famous actor and producer. You have heard of him?"
"Of course. I shall enjoy tossing him a scrap or two of fish in exchange for the pleasure he has given me in his other incarnation." The sweat began to pour down Bond's face and chest into his bathing pants. Kissy undid the kerchief round her hair and leant forward and mopped at him gently. Bond smiled into her almond eyes and had his first close-up of her snub nose and petalled mouth. She wore no makeup and did not need to, for she had that rosy-tinted skin on a golden background, the colours of a golden peach that is quite common in Japan. Her hair, released from the kerchief, was black with dark brown highlights. It was heavily waved, but with a soft fringe that ended an inch or so above the straight, fine eyebrows that showed no signs of having been plucked. Her teeth were even, and showed no more prominently between the lips than with a European girl, so that she avoided the toothiness that is a weak point in the Japanese face. Her arms and legs were longer and less masculine than is usual with Japanese girls, and the day before, Bond had seen that her breasts and buttocks were firm and proud, and that her stomach was almost flat. A beautiful figure, equal to that of any of the star chorus girls he had seen in the cabarets of Tokyo. But her hands and feet were rough and scarred with work, and her fingernails and toenails, although they were cut very short, were broken. Bond found this rather endearing. Ama means sea girl or sea man, and Kissy wore the marks of competing with the creatures of the ocean with obvious indifference. And her skin, which might have suffered from constant contact with salt water, in fact glowed with a golden sheen of health and vitality. But it was the charm and directness of her eyes and smile, as well as her complete naturalness, for instance when she mopped at Bond's face and chest, that endeared her so utterly to Bond. At that moment, he thought there would be nothing more wonderful than to spend the rest of his life rowing her out towards the horizon during the day, and coming back with her to the small, clean house in the dusk. He shrugged the whimsy aside. Only another 2 days to the full moon, and he would have to get back to reality, to the dark, dirty life he had chosen for himself. He put the prospect out of his mind. Today and the next day would be stolen days, days only with Kissy and the boat and the bird and the sea. He must just see to it that they were happy days and lucky ones for her and her harvest of seashells. Kissy said, "Not much longer. And you have rowed well." She gestured to the right, to where the rest of the Ama fleet was spread out over the ocean. "With us, it is first come, first served, with the sights we choose. Today we can get out as far as a shoal most of us know of, and we shall have it to ourselves. There the seaweed is thick on the rocks, and that is what the Awabi feed on. It is deep, about 40 feet, but I can stay down for almost a minute, long enough to pick up 2, 3 Awabi if I can find them. That is just a matter of luck in feeling about with the hands among the seaweed, for you rarely see the shells. You only feel them and dislodge them with this." She tapped her angular pick. "After a while, I shall have to rest. Then perhaps you would like to go down, yes? Now tell me you're a good swimmer,
and I have brought a pair of my father's goggles. These bulbs at the sides, she showed him, have to be squeezed to equalize the pressure between the glasses and the eyes. You will perhaps not be able to stay down long to begin with, but you will learn quickly. How long will you be staying on Kuro?
Only 2 or 3 days, I'm afraid.
Oh, but that is sad. What will David and I do for a boatman then?
Perhaps your father will get better.
That is so. I must take him to a cure place at one of the volcanoes on the mainland. Otherwise it will mean marrying one of the men on Kuro. That is not easy. The choice is not wide, and because I have a little money from my film work, and a little is a lot on Kuro, the man might want to marry me for the wrong reasons. That would be sad. And how is one to know?
Perhaps you will go back into films.
Her expression became fierce. Never. I hated it. They were all disgusting to me in Hollywood. They thought that because I am a Japanese, I am some sort of an animal, and that my body is for everyone. Nobody treated me honorably, except this Niven.
She shook her head to get rid of the memories.
No. I will stay on Kuro forever. The gods will solve my problems.
She smiled.
Like they have today.
She scanned the sea ahead.
100 yards.
She got up, and balancing perfectly despite the swell, tied the end of the long rope round her waist and adjusted the goggles above her forehead.
Now, remember, keep the rope taut, and when you feel one tug, pull me up quickly. It will be hard work for you, but I will massage your back when we get home this evening. I am very good at it. I have had enough practice with my father. Now.
Bond shipped the oars gratefully. Behind him, David began shifting on his feet, craning his long neck and hissing impatiently. Kissy tied a short line to the wooden tub and put it over the side. She followed, slipping decorously into the water and clasping her white dress between her knees so that it did not flower out around her. At once, David dived and disappeared without a ripple. The line, tied to Bond's thwart, began paying out fast. He picked up the coil of Kissy's rope and stood up, his joints cracking. Kissy pulled down her goggles and put her head under water. In a moment she came up. She smiled.
Yes, it looks fine down there.
She rested in the water and began making a soft, cooing whistle through pursed lips to fill her lungs to the uttermost, Bond assumed. Then, with a brief wave of the hand, she put down her head and arched her hips so that Bond had a brief sight of the black string cleaving her behind under the thin material. Suddenly, like a fleeting white wraith, she was gone, straight down, her feet twinkling behind her in a fast crawl to help the pull of the weights. Bond paid out fast, keeping an anxious eye on his watch. David appeared below him, bearing a half-pound silvery fish crosswise in his beak. Damn the bird, this was no time to get mixed up with retrieving fish from the extremely sharp-looking beak. But with a contemptuous glance, the cormorant tossed the fish into the floating tub and disappeared like a black bullet. 50 seconds. Bond started nervously when the tug came. He pulled in fast. The white wraith appeared far below in the crystal water, and as she came up, Bond saw that her hands were tight against her sides to streamline her body. She broke surface beside the boat and held out 2 fat awabi to show him, and then dropped them into the tub. She held onto the side of the boat to regain her breath, and Bond gazed down at the wonderful breasts, taut beneath their thin covering. She smiled briefly up at him, began her cooing whistle, and then came the exciting arch of the back. And she was gone again. An hour went by. Bond got used to the routine and had time to watch the nearest of the fleet of other boats. They covered perhaps a mile of sea, and from across the silent water there came the recurrent eerie whistle, a soft seabird sound of the diving girls. The nearest boat rocked in the slow swell, perhaps 100 yards away, and Bond watched the young man at the rope and caught an occasional glimpse of a beautiful golden body, shiny as a seal, and heard the excited chattering of their voices. He hoped he would not disgrace himself when it came to his turn to dive. Sake and cigarettes, not a good mixture to train on. The pile of awabi was slowly growing in the tub, and amongst them perhaps 12 leaping fish. Occasionally Bond bent down and retrieved one from David. Once he dropped a slippery fish and the bird had to dive for it again. This time he received an even haughtier look of scorn from the turquoise eyes. Then Kissy came up, her stint done, and climbed, not so decorously this time, into the boat and tore off her kerchief and goggles and sat panting quietly in the stern. Finally she looked up and laughed happily.
That is 21. Very good. Now take my weights and pick, and see for yourself what it is like down there. But I will pull you up anyway in 30 seconds. Give me your watch, and please do not lose my tegane, my pick, or our day's fishing will be over.
Bond's first dive was a clumsy affair. He went down too slowly and barely had time to survey the grassy plains scattered with black rocks and clumps of posidonia, the common seaweed of all the oceans, when he felt himself being hauled up. He had to admit to himself that his lungs were in terrible shape, but he had spied one promising rock thick with weed, and on his next dive he got straight to it and clung, searching among the roots with his right hand. He felt the smooth oval of a shell, but before he could get the pick to it he was being pulled up again. But he got the shell on his third try, and Kissy laughed with pleasure as he dropped it into the tub. He managed to keep the diving up for about half an hour, but then his lungs began to ache and his body to feel the cold of the October sea, and when he came up for the last time, simultaneously with David, who shot past him like a beautiful gleaming black fish with green highlights, and, as a mark of approval, pecked gently at his hair as Bond deposited his fifth shell in the tub. Kissy was pleased with him. She had a rough brown kimono in the boat, and she rubbed him down with it as he sat with bowed head and heaving chest. Then, while he rested, she hauled the wooden tub inboard and emptied its contents into the bottom of the boat. She produced a knife and cut one of the fish down the middle and fed the two halves to David, who was riding expectantly beside the boat. He swallowed the pieces in two great gulps and set to preening his feathers contentedly. Later, they stopped for a lunch of rice with a few small bits of fish in it and dried seaweed, which tasted of salty spinach. And then, after a short rest in the bottom of the boat, the work went on until 4 o'clock, when a small chill breeze came from nowhere and got between them and the warmth of the sun, and it was time to make the long row home. Kissy climbed for the last time into the boat and gave several soft tugs at David's line. He surfaced some distance from the boat and, as if this were a well-worn routine, rose into the air and circled round them again and again before making a low dive and skiing in to the side of the boat on his webbed feet. He flapped his way over the side and went to his perch, where he stood with wings magnificently outstretched to dry and waited in this lordly stance for his boatman to take him back home to his cove. Kissy changed with extreme propriety into her brown kimono and dried herself inside it. She announced that their haul was 65 awabi, which was quite wonderful. Of these, Bond was responsible for 10, which was a very honourable first catch. Ridiculously pleased with himself, Bond took a vague bearing on the island, which, because of the drifting of the boat, was now only a speck on the horizon, and gradually worked himself into the slow, unlaboured sweep of a Scottish gillie. His hands were sore, his back ached as if he had been thrashed with a wooden truncheon, and his shoulders were beginning to sting with sunburn, but he comforted himself with the reflection that he was only doing what he would have had to do anyway— get into training for the swim and the climb, and what would come afterwards. And he rewarded himself from time to time with a smile into Kissy's eyes. They never left him, and the low sun shone into them and turned the soft brown to gold. And the speck became a lump, and the lump an island, and at last they were home.
Chapter 15. The Six Guardians. The next day was as golden as the first, and the haul of awabi went up to 68, largely thanks to Bond's improved diving. The evening before, Kissy had come back from selling her shells at the market and had found Bond writhing on the floor of his room with cramps in his stomach muscles and her mother clucking helplessly over him. She had shooed her mother away, spread the soft futon on the floor beside him, and had pulled off his bathing pants and rolled him onto the futon face downwards. Then she had stood upright on his back,
and had walked softly up and down his spine from his buttocks to his neck, and the ache had slowly gone. She told him to lie still and brought him warm milk. Then she led him into the tiny bathhouse and poured hot and then tepid water over him from an awabi tub until all the salt was out of his skin and hair. She dried him softly, rubbed warm milk into his sunburn and his chafed hands, and led him back to his room, telling him with gentle sternness to go to sleep and to call her if he awoke in the night and needed anything. She blew out his candle and left him, and he went out to the night song of the cricket in its cage like a light. In the morning, nothing remained of his aches except the soreness of the hands, and Kissy gave him the rare treat of an egg beaten up in his rice and bean curd, and he apologized for his bad manners of the night before. She said, "Todoroki-san, you have the spirit of 10 samurai, but you have the body of only one. I should have known that I had asked too much of that single body. It was the pleasure of the day. It made me forget everything else. So it is I who apologize, and today we will not go so far. Instead, we will keep close to the cliffs of the island and see what we can find. I will do the rowing, for it is a small distance. But you will be able to do more diving, because the place that I know of, which I haven't visited for many weeks, is inshore, and the water is, at the most, 20 feet deep." And so it had been. And Bond had worn a shirt to protect him from the sun, and his tally of shells had gone up to 21, and the solitary shadow of the day had been the clear view he had had of the black fortress across the straits, and the chunky yellow and black warning balloon that flew the column of black ideograms above it. During one of their rests, Bond casually asked Kissy what she knew of the castle, and he was surprised by the way her face darkened.
"Todoroki-san, we do not usually talk about that place. It is almost a forbidden subject on Kuro. It is as if hell had suddenly opened its mouth half a mile away across the sea from our home. And my people, the Ama, are like what I have read about your gypsies. We are very superstitious, and we believe the devil himself has come to live over there."
She didn't look at the fortress, but gestured with her head.
"Even the Kanoshi-san does not deny our fears. And our elders say that the gaijins have always been bad for Japan, and that this one is the incarnation of all the evil in the West. And there is already a legend that has grown up on the island. It is that our 6 Jinzō guardians will send a man from across the sea to slay this King of Death, as we call him."
"Who are these guardians?"
"Jinzō is the god who protects children. He is, I think, a Buddhist god. On the other side of the island, on the foreshore, there are 5 statues. The 6th has been mostly washed away. They are rather frightening to see. They squat there in a line. They have rough bodies of stone and round stones for heads, and they wear white shirts that are changed by the people every month. They were put there centuries ago by our ancestors. They sit on the line of low tide, and as the tide comes up, it covers them completely, and they keep watch under the surface of the sea and protect us, the Ama, because we are known as the children of the sea. At the beginning of every June, when the sea is warm after the winter and the diving begins, every person on the island forms into a procession, and we go to the 6 guardians and sing to them to make them happy and favorable towards us."
"And this story of the man from Kuro, where did it come from?"
"Who knows? It could have come from the sea or the air, and thus into the minds of the people. Where do stories like that come from? It is widely believed."
"Oh, so desu ka," said Bond, and they both laughed and got on with the work. On the 3rd day, when Bond was, as usual, eating his breakfast on the doorstep, Kissy came to the doorway and said softly,
"Come inside, Todoroki-san."
Mystified, he went in, and she shut the door behind him. She said in a low voice,
"I have just heard from a messenger from the Kanoshi-san that there were people here yesterday in a boat from the mainland. They brought presentos, cigarettes and sweets. They were asking about the visit of the police boat. They said it came with 3 visitors and left with only 2. They wanted to know what had happened to the third visitor. They said they were guards from the castle, and it was their duty to prevent trespassers. The elders accepted the presentos, but they showed Shirankau, which is the face of him who knows nothing, and referred the men to the Kanushi-san, who said that the third visitor was in charge of fishing licenses. He felt sick on the way to the island and had perhaps lain down in the boat on the way back. Then he dismissed the men and sent a boy to the top of the high place to see where the boat went, and the boy reported that it went to the bay beside the castle and was put back into the boathouse that is there. The Kanushi-san thought that you should know these things. She looked at him piteously. Todoroki-san, I have a feeling of much friendship for you. I feel that there are secret things between you and the Kanushi-san, and that they concern the castle. I think you should tell me enough to put me out of my unhappiness.
Bon smiled. He went up to her and took her face in both his hands and kissed her on the lips. He said, "You are very beautiful and kind, Kisi. Today we will not take the boat out, because I must have some rest. Lead me up to the high place from which I can take a good look at this castle, and I will tell you what I can. I was going to anyway, for I shall need your help. Afterwards, I would like to visit the Six Guardians. They interest me, as an anthropologist." Kissy collected their usual lunch in a small basket, put on her brown kimono and rope-soled shoes, and they set off along a small footpath that zigzagged up the peak behind the crouching grey cluster of the village. The time of the camellia was almost past, but here there were occasional bushes of wild camellias in red and white, and there was a profusion of these round a small grove of dwarf maples, some of which already wore their flaming autumn colours. The grove was directly above Kissy's house. She let him in, and showed him the little Shinto shrine behind a rough stone torii. She said, "Behind the shrine, there is a fine cave, but the people of Kuro are afraid of it as it is full of ghosts. But I explored it once, and if there are ghosts there, they are friendly ones." She clapped her hands before the shrine, bent her head for a moment, and clapped them again. Then they went on up the path to the top of the 1,000-foot peak. A brace of gorgeous copper pheasants with golden tails fled squawking over the brow and down to a patch of bushes on the southern cliff as they approached. Bond told Kissy to stay out of sight while he went and stood behind the tall cairn of stones on the summit and gazed circumspectly round it and across the straits. He could see over the high fortress wall and across the park to the towering black and gold donjon of the castle. It was 10 o'clock. There were figures in blue peasant dress with high boots and long staves moving busily about the grounds. They occasionally seemed to prod into the bushes with their staves. They wore black maskers over their mouths. It crossed Bond's mind that they might be doing the morning rounds, looking for overnight prey. What did they do when they found some half-blinded creature, or a pile of clothes beside one of the fumaroles whose little clouds of steam rose here and there in the park? Take them to the doctor? And, in the case of the living, what happened then? And when he, Bond, got up that wall tonight, where was he going to hide from the guards? Well, sufficient unto the day. At least the straits were calm, and it was cloudless weather. It looked as if he would get there all right. Bond turned away and went back to Kissy, and sat with her on the sparse turf. He gazed across the harbour to where the Amma fleet lay sprawled across the middle distance. He said, "Kissy, tonight I have to swim to the castle and climb the wall and get inside." She nodded. "I know this. And then you're going to kill this man and perhaps his wife. You are the man who we believe was to come to Kuro from across the sea and do these things." She continued to gaze out to sea. She said dully, "But why have you been chosen? Why should it not be another, a Japanese? These people are gaijins. I am a gaijin. It will cause less trouble for the state if the whole matter is presented as being trouble between foreigners."
"Yes, I see. And has the Kanushi-san given his approval?"
"Yes."
"And if... And... after, will you come back and be my boatman again?
For a time. But then I must go back to England.
No. I believe that you will stay for a long time on Kuro.
Why do you believe that?
Because I prayed for it at the shrine. And I have never asked for such a big thing before. I'm sure it will be granted.
She paused.
And I shall be swimming with you tonight. She held up a hand. You will need company in the dark, and I know the currents. You will not get there without me.
Bond took the small, dry paw in his. He looked at the childish, broken nails. His voice was harsh. He said, No, this is man's work.
She looked at him.
The brown eyes were calm and serious. She said, and she used his first name,
Taro-san. Your other name may mean thunder, but I am not frightened of thunder. I have made up my mind, and I shall come back every night at midnight exactly, and wait among the rocks at the bottom of the wall. I shall wait for 1 hour in case you need my help in coming home. These people may harm you. Women are much stronger in the water than men. That is why it is the Ama girls who dive and not the Ama men. I know the waters round Kuro, as a peasant knows the fields round his farm, and I have as little fear of them. Do not be stiff-necked in this matter. In any case, I shall hardly sleep until you come back. To feel that I am close to you for a time, and that you may need me, will give me some peace. Say yes, Taro-san.
Oh, all right, Kissy, said Bond gruffly. I was only going to ask you to row me to a starting point down there somewhere. He gestured to the left across the straits. But if you insist on being an extra target for the sharks...
The sharks never trouble us. The Six Guardians look after that. We never come to any harm. Years ago, one of the Amas caught a rope in a rock underwater, and the people have talked of the accident ever since. The sharks just think we are big fish like themselves, she laughed happily. Now it is all settled, and we can have something to eat, and then I will take you down to see the guardians. The tide will be low by then, and they will want to inspect you.
They followed another little path from the summit. It went over the shoulder of the peak and down to a small protected bay to the east of the village. The tide was far out, and they could wade over the flat black pebbles and rocks and round the corner of the promontory. Here, on a stretch of flat, stony beach, five people squatted on a square foundation of large rocks and gazed out towards the horizon. Except that they weren't people. They were, as Kissy had described, stone pedestal bodies with large round boulders cemented to their tops. But rough white shirts were roped round them, and they looked terrifyingly human as they sat in immobile judgment and guardianship over the waters and what went on beneath them. Of the sixth, only the body remained. His head must have been destroyed by a storm. They walked round in front of the five and looked up at the smooth, blank faces, and Bond, for the first time in his life, had a sensation of deep awe. So much belief, so much authority seemed to have been invested by the builders in these primitive, faceless idols, guardians of the blithe, naked Ama girls, that Bond had a ridiculous urge to kneel and ask for their blessing, as the Crusaders had once done before their god. He brushed the impulse aside, but he did bow his head and briefly ask for good fortune to accompany his enterprise. And then he stood back and watched, with a pull at his heartstrings, while Kissy, her beautiful face strained and pleading, clapped to attract their attention, and then made a long and impassioned speech in which his name recurred. At the end, when she again clapped her hands, did the round boulder heads briefly nod? Of course not. But when Bond took Kissy's hand and they walked away, she said happily, It is all right, Todoroki-san. You saw them, not their heads? No, said Bond firmly. I did not. They crept round the eastern shore of Kuro and pulled the boat up into a deep cleft in the black rocks.
It was just after 11 o'clock, and the giant moon rode high and fast through wisps of mackerel cloud. They talked softly, although they were out of sight of the fortress and half a mile away from it. Kissy took off her brown kimono and folded it neatly and put it in the boat. Her body glowed in the moonlight. The black triangle between her legs beckoned, and the black string round her waist that held the piece of material was an invitation to untie it. She giggled provocatively. "Stop looking at my black cat. Why is it called that? Guess." Bond carefully pulled on his ninja suit of black cotton. It was comfortable enough and would give warmth in the water. He left the head shroud hanging down his back and pushed the goggles that belonged to Kissy's father up his forehead. The small floating pack he was to tow behind him rode jauntily in the waters of the creek, and he tied its string firmly to his right waist so that he would always know it was there. He smiled at Kissy and nodded. She came up to him and threw her arms round his neck and kissed him full on the lips. Before he could respond, she had pulled down her goggles and had dived into the quiet mercury sea.